let's stop for a minute and think about some things. I'm ML Laurie, and welcome to the fourth episode of What the Hell is Going On. Today, I thought I would present you with another viewpoint other than my own. There's a lovely woman who works at my acupuncture's office. And for some time now, when I go in to have an acupuncture treatment, her and I have spent time talking about different things. Each time we have a conversation, it hits me how much she is talking about the things that I am talking about here in the podcast. So I can bring in some kind of professional or spiritual teacher and things like that, and maybe I will do that in the future. But I thought, how much more powerful would it be to invite another human being instead to have a conversation with me, a human being to human being, not a conversation, a professional to another human being. So this is what we're going to do in this episode. I will be introducing you to Carrie, and we will be having a conversation about what the hell is going on. And in particular, the title of this segment, Is There a Better Way? In other words, is there a better way to have more happiness in your life? So I'm here talking to Carrie. She has very kindly said that she would come in and have a conversation with me and giving herself a little bit of a hard time about, you know, does she really have anything to offer? And I keep telling her how wonderful she is. And of course she does, because she is a human being and she's been through some things that I think can be very helpful for other people to hear. So tell me something about yourself, Carrie.
Well, I've spent about 30 years almost in human resources and accounting and management positions, and as I've started looking into myself and what really makes me happy, the money wasn't making me happy, the stressful jobs weren't making me happy, so I had to find something that did, which also meant adjusting my lifestyle to a new income level. And so now I have a job that I love, that I get to speak with people every day that are in there to be healed, you know, and for healing, and to share their experiences with me as they do that. And to me, that's so much more fulfilling than the 8-to-5 job where you are making decisions.
I hear what you're saying. What you're saying is that the money was great.
Yeah.
And you had some kind of position and some kind of something probably good for your self-esteem that you're in this position.
Yes.
So you're in management and you get all these kudos from that. But something was missing.
Right. Absolutely.
And what was missing was?
That internal feeling of fulfillment. I think I was going through the motions because I needed to make a mortgage payment and get a new car, because that's what's always kind of, I felt, was expected of me. And so that goes back to childhood, and you have certain expectations to live up to. None of them were internal, and what makes you happy and things like that. It was all, what do you have and what are you showing other people? And I learned that was how people would judge me. And so that's what I would always strive for. But then at some point you realize you're giving up yourself when you're meeting everybody else's expectations.
As I sit here with you, I actually have tears coming up in my eyes, because I feel so happy that somebody has realized the faultiness of all this stuff, and that somebody has decided that they want more happiness in their life and they found a better way.
Oh, absolutely. I probably make half of what I used to make, and it's the first time in my life I've truly been content and very happy with what I have.
So how did this come to be? How did you get this realization that you needed a better way?
I guess it started when I was 21. I had a baby girl that passed away. And so with that, of course, at 21, I didn't have a great emotional awareness anyway. But so then when I was in a depression and, you know, grieving the loss of my daughter, people around me were concerned. And so I went to the doctor and I was put on antidepressants. And I was never at a point, or I wasn't back then, where I could question things. I just followed along. And I did that for years. So when I would start to get sad again, they would raise the antidepressants. And I would go through therapy sessions for years, on and off, about why I was sad. And it was never brought up that I really never grieved. And so I carried that along for years. And it builds and it builds. Until one day, my son, who was a year and a half when my daughter died, and I think that was one of the other reasons that I really felt like I needed to be okay right away to raise my son. So I went on the antidepressants, and one day, he was probably in middle school by then, I just realized I was absent in some way. I mean, he played sports and he did great in school and I was always there, but I wasn't really feeling it. I think I was trying to remember back to certain events and I couldn't remember how I felt. You know, you look at pictures and say, well, you look happy, but I don't remember feeling happy. And so I started looking for something else, some other way to handle my lack of emotion at that point, because I had no emotions. It was just, I was a little numb from the medication. And so I started to wean myself off of those. And at the same time, trying to figure out how to handle the death of my daughter, because I think at some level I realized that was probably where I was stunted in my, you know, emotional development, was that I wasn't able to grieve at that time. So I was looking at certain things, and I looked into ayahuasca, actually.
I don't know what's that. What is that?
It started in Peru, from what I understand. I'm not very clear on the origins of it, but it's basically there's a plant root and there's a liquid, and together it's almost a psychedelic, I believe. And I had been reading about this for a while and how when you take it, it resets your brain. You live through these traumatic events again while you're taking it, and it resets your brain cells. So instead of thinking about her and wanting to cry, I now think of her, and I just am so joyful that I had her, and I can talk about her now, when before I couldn't even talk about her. And it's kind of a spiritual thing where they say it finds you when you're ready, and it was kind of a strange thing. On Facebook, a girl that I went to school with, like junior high and high school, I hadn't talked to her in maybe 20 years, but she posted that an organization was coming to the coast, Oregon coast, for ayahuasca ceremony, because I could never travel to Peru. I didn't realize it was available in the U.S. anywhere. It's very strictly enforced as far as, you know, you have to have a license and be registered to get these ingredients. And it happened to be coming on my daughter's birthday weekend. So to me, that was very significant. She and I went to that. She didn't get anything, unfortunately, that whole night. But with the work of the shaman that was there that led us through, or led me personally through and took the time to guide me on how to bring things up that I wanted to address. And it was a really traumatic evening, and there was a lot of crying and, you know, nausea and things like that. But I woke up the next day, and it was like 50 pounds had been lifted off my shoulders. And I think that opened me up a little bit. I opened up my brain probably a little bit to other things other than what I've been taught my whole life, is if you're not feeling well, you take a pill or things like that, that you have to, that we don't have it within ourselves to fix things that are coming up or address issues. And so that opened me up a lot more. I was able to stop the antidepressants, and I haven't had them in 10 years, you know, more than that probably. I've never been depressed in that time. I've had sad days, but it's not depression. It's just life.
You've hit on so many things. I'm a therapist, but my training's through the School of Nursing, so I'm a clinical nurse specialist, a mental health clinical nurse specialist, which is a therapist degree, but it also has the background of like a nurse practitioner, mental health nurse practitioner. Yeah. So technically, if I wanted to prescribe medications and I went through the right hoops, I could do that. But I'm not a big believer in a lot of the medications. Right. You know, and I've got 40 years plus in the field of psychology. And one of those things I don't believe in is giving people antidepressants in a grief process, because as you experienced, it stunts your ability to go through the grief process. And until you go through the grief process, you can't move on.
I agree completely. And that was my experience as well. Once I was able to do that, and it's very traumatic. And I come from a background of a family that doesn't show emotion, and you put on the face that everything's okay, and that's what you want the world to see. So you could go home and deal with what you had to, but as soon as somebody was there, you put on the smile and everything's fine. And I feel like I missed a lot of things by being medicated for so many years when I didn't need it. So I don't negate the need for medications and things, because there are people that are clinically depressed and that need that kind of support, and I don't think I fell into that category.
No, there are real specific situations where you would maybe use an antidepressant, sure, not in a grief process.
Right, I agree.
But there might be particular instances where that might be different, but most of the time not. And definitely for anyone who has the diagnosis of schizophrenia, it's a pretty torturous disease. And so to relieve their suffering, I think medication can be very helpful for them so they can be out and function in the world. The side effects are not so great, though. So it's hard for people to stay on them. But most of the time, we are in a culture, I'll talk about America because that's our culture, and this is a culture where you want a quick fix.
Exactly.
And people don't know better. You take a pill. You got a headache? You take a pill. Well, I'm sad? We'll take a pill. I've actually had clients in my office where they're talking to me about a situation, and after a few sessions, I've said this before, well, I can't fix you. And they'll go, well, why the hell am I here? And it's like, oh, that's what we need to talk about. Because, you know, if I could fix you, I would have fixed the whole world
right.
by now if I could fix people. But I can't. And that's a very sad thing for me. And so I do it in whatever way I can, like with this podcast. And I'm always delighted when I have people like you who can share their story about how there's a better way. This is the whole thing that we're talking about in this podcast. We have all these toxic cultural myths that are lies.
Completely.
The lie about not crying. Chuck it up. Be tough. Be strong. Well, your body has the tear ducts. It's built in there for the release. And if you're actually going with the culture of chuck it up and be strong and not cry, it takes a lot more strength to say, forget you and cry. Because that's what you need to do and that's what's healthy.
Absolutely.
So I'm really grateful for that. And the other thing that you hit on was this idea of being sad. As I get down in my podcast, I'm going to be talking about a lot of the things that people don't realize they share as human beings. And one of those things is there's a sadness that comes with just being alive.
Absolutely.
That's because, gosh, we got to go to the grocery shopping and got to pay the bills and I got to do this and I got to do that. It just takes a lot of energy just being in the world. And sometimes there's a sadness that comes with that. And I used to talk to people about that when I was a younger therapist, and people go, I don't know what you're talking about. I used to call it a depression, actually. And nobody was, I don't know what you're talking about. And we're talking about psych professionals. And I found a psychiatrist that had the conversation with me. He was aware, and he said, yeah, but I don't think it's a depression, Lori. I said, you know, do you think there's a depression that goes with being alive? And he said, no, I think it's more of a sadness. And it's like, well, you're right. It is a sadness. But it doesn't have to be a bad thing. And, you know, when you say, okay, so I'm sad today. Okay. I won't be sad tomorrow. I'm not sad every minute. Maybe I'm sad for these minutes and then half an hour from now. Maybe I won't be sad. Because it's just part of all the difficulties that we go through in life. It's part of living.
Well, and that's a big part of it, I think, because when I say I was going through a depression, when I look back, I was very upset, obviously, after the loss. But I was still getting up every day and taking care of my son. But the people around me, I was crying a lot, of course. I had trouble letting my son out of my sight, you know.
Oh, of course.
And things like that. But that's very normal.
Yes.
But it wasn't for the people around me. Mm. And they were worried about me. And if I had just been given a little time to keep crying and work through it, I think it would have been very different. I mean, it would have changed a lot of things in my life if I had gone that route. And I just didn't know any better. And they didn't either. They didn't.
They don't know better. And the bottom line is that when you didn't toe the line of chucking it up and keeping it all inside, they got scared.
Absolutely. And anything off the deviated path was scary. And who knows what's going to happen, you know. Worst case scenario there. I've never had anybody in our family hospitalized or anything like that, but mental health was never discussed and emotions were just taboo.
Yeah, for sure. I think you said there was some substance abuse mm-hmm. involved, and what do you do to keep the emotions down? Well, you drink or take drugs,
right.
And that's part of what's behind the drug and alcohol issues in our country, why they're so strong.
Completely. My mother was an alcoholic my mm-hmm. whole life, and I didn't understand at the time. I do now, and she's passed away, but she had issues, emotional issues as well, and the generation before her didn't know how to handle that, mm-hmm. and so she didn't know how to handle it, so she would drink, and none of us kids got that problem. I mean, none of us have ever been drinkers. I mean, I almost abstain practically because I memories, I guess. Mm. And that was the only way she could deal with life every day. In retrospect, if she had been given an option, or if she knew that something else was out there, that would have helped her so much. And so she didn't have the tools to pass along to me. So then this is the generation where we break that in my family, because I'm not going to pass that to my son.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. And my son's first baby is due next month.
Oh,
so
wow.
I know this, the timing for everything fell into place, because I talked to him about that as well, that I'm going to be a better grandparent than I was a parent. And I know more now, and I don't give advice to them on parenting. I say, this is what I wish I had done differently. And I really want him to be aware of his emotions before he has a child, because she's due in April. You know, my first grandchild, his first child. And so this is a generation where we take a different path.
What was his response when you said that to him?
He's very receptive. He and I lived by ourselves for many years, and he's just an incredible human being anyway, mm-hmm. but he's very intelligent, and he wants to do better too. And mm-hmm. and we talk about things that I could have done differently, and he's never judgmental or belittling about anything, but we're still very close, and he's very receptive to it, because I think he sees what I've been doing and how that's made me a happier person, more content with less. And so I think when he was young, I was feeding into that, we have to look nice, we have to do this and say things like this and do things like that because it's expected. And so I wanted him to maybe see that that wasn't the only way. And he can still choose whichever way he wants, but he will have the tools to make his decisions.
That's very powerful when a parent says to a child, I wish I had done something different. Because what that does is open the door for the child to talk about anything they might need to talk about.
And that's exactly why I did it, because he didn't deal with the neglect and the issues maybe that I had when I was young. But of course, there's other issues. When you're not mentally 100% there, there's things I wish that I had responded to differently or done differently. And he's just never been judgmental on anything. And he's always kind of been afraid of hurting my feelings, I think, and not wanting to talk about certain things because he didn't know how I would handle it. But that's how I never brought anything up to my mother either. And so I wanted that conversation to be opened as far as being able to discuss things like that. I see things more clearly now. So there's things that may have upset him at the time that I never knew. But I want him to be able to be open with me, and I think that will in turn make him a better parent than I was. And he's never said anything negative about my parenting ever, but I see it. You know, I see things now.
When he's older at some point, if he can have that conversation, because you were coming from your perspective and he was coming from his. Mm-hmm. So your perception of the event and his perception of the event could be very different.
Right, sure.
But as a child, it's interesting. I worked with people who were severely abused. And even that severely abused person wants the love of that parent.
Absolutely.
It doesn't, you know, and that's the power of that bond with a parent. So children very often are protective of the parent.
Completely.
Yeah, maybe unconsciously it's because they're protecting themselves. But in reality, they love their parents. And so there's an automatic sort of protective mode. My mother died when I was 11, and there was a lot of trash going on in the family about it was my father's fault. And she died. We don't know why she died. It was just she was alive and then she was dead, and the autopsy was inconclusive. And the family was saying horrible things in front of us children, his children, like, oh, it's his fault she died and things like that. And I said that to him once, and he broke down crying. And I was just, like, horrified that my father was crying. And I felt so bad. And so after that time, I realized, now that I'm older, how I went into protective mode. Protecting
Absolutely.
My father.
Yeah.
So that's just what children do.
He was.
So would it be correct to say, Carrie, that you feel like you found a better way?
Absolutely.
And how long ago did that happen for you?
I think I didn't really notice it at first. Mm-hmm. It's more of a gradual thing. After processing the grief of my daughter's death and being able to even say the words my daughter's death that I haven't been able to say in 20 years, everything kind of opens up to you. Everything's okay to talk about, because that's the biggest elephant in the room, is something like that. And so that freed me up to talk about so many things. And I have my core group of friends are the ones I had in junior high and high school. And I never really talked about emotions with them. So I was hesitant to maybe bring things up. But once I did, it opened up our relationship to a new level because they were very receptive. I think in retrospect, I was the one that was stopping those conversations. And so we didn't talk about things. So then that gave me the impression that, this is not something that people talk about because these are my very good friends and still are. I mean, I love them more than, as much as my family. But I think I was the one who kind of put up the barriers on that. So once I started talking to them, they would start talking about their emotions as well. Different issues, but very traumatic. You know, we all have different traumatic events and the same feelings about those. But we never really talked about it because I think I was giving off the impression I was emotionally unavailable, which in a sense I was. But once we started opening up, it flourished. And so now nothing is off limits. And we can sit and cry when we're talking about something, and it's okay. And to me, that's more healing than therapy. You know, when you're sitting in a living room with your friend of 25 years and just able to cry and hug each other, walking away from that has made me feel better than almost anything else that I could have done.
Do you mind telling me how old you are?
48.
Okay. So it was like you had these friends, and they were your friends, and they stayed in your life. And now that you've been able to open up more, both of you, and share your emotions, mm-hmm. it's really strengthened and cemented your relationship even more.
Absolutely. It's really shown me that I'm the one who would lead the relationships with the people around me, whether it was friends or boyfriends or family even. I would put off the impression of, yes, I'm available to speak about emotional things, or I'm not. And other people respond in kind. So when I was kind of putting up the roadblocks to not talk about things, well, then they felt they couldn't either. So opening up these conversations has really shown me that we all have something we want to talk about. We just don't always have someone to talk about it with.
We all have issues. Some people won't be old enough to remember this, but there was a TV show called Leave It to Beaver. And these white suburb people, and the wife, her hair was always exactly in place, and the father was out working, and she was a housewife. And then you have these two kids, and then life was perfect, and Beaver was the youngest one. And so everything was good and wonderful, supportive, caring family who was always there for each other. And I tell people, Leave It to Beaver does not exist. You can have a really great family and a really supportive family, but you will have issues because things come up because you are in the world and you are a human being. And to be a human being in this culture of all these crazy lies or myths that we grow up in, you're going to have issues. And in fairness to you, you may think that you stopped the sharing of emotions with your friends. I don't know if you've shared that with them, but I would think that that's probably not the case because teenagers are not really good about sharing their emotions because they're more worried about peers and pressure from peers and how they look and how they appear. And, you know, I certainly didn't share any of my emotions with friends, and stories I've told them now that I'm older, they're like, wow, I had no idea that happened. It's like, well, yeah, you know, that happened. Especially if there's any shame involved. Kids don't tell you. It's like I tell people, until you hit your 20s, you're just trying to survive. And then you hit 20 and you hit stupidity. By stupidity, not to dog anyone who's 20 that might be listening, but by stupidity, I mean you think you have to live the world on everybody else's terms. And then when you hit your 30s, if you're lucky, you start to realize that, you know what? This is actually my life. And I can actually live it in the way that I choose to live it. And then when you hit 40, maybe you're lucky, or maybe before, you know, everybody develops differently, especially based upon their experience. You might start getting glimpses of wisdom. Once I was in Indianapolis, and I had a client who had come to Indianapolis from South Bend and was staying with her grandmother while she was looking for a place, and she wanted to move out. She was quite young, you know, early 20s, but she felt bad about her grandmother being alone, and she would tell me stories about her grandmother playing cards with her friends, and I said, well, what about her friends? And she said, well, you know, the one that's most available, you know, she still gossips about everybody, and she says really hateful things, and she said, can you believe that? She's 70 years old, and she still does that. And it's like, well, yes, I can believe that, because unless you work through your issues, you can be that same hateful child that you were at 70 years old. Because if you don't deal with things, they don't go away. Luckily for you and I, we were able to get some kind of clue and find a better way. instead of being caught up in the craziness that goes on and on and on until you find a better way. So is there anything more that you can share with me about how you started this journey? Did you actually take this substance?
Mm-hmm.
And do you think it was the substance, or you think it was actually just being able to release all that bent up grief that you had?
I think it was the substance that allowed me to. I think I'd never had that freedom before. And actually, for a couple of weeks leading up to it, you couldn't have any medications. And so I had a clear mind when I went in there. And they administer to you. It's got to be, you have to be, you know, in one, there was like a beach house they rented for the night. You're contained for that night because they won't let you go anywhere because it does alter your perspective and certain things. And so I remember a lot of what happened that night, my thoughts and things that I would see. It was almost hallucinations. But it was related to my daughter's death. And I grieved so much in that evening alone. It was a full 24-hour period, I guess, but during that night, and it was extremely dramatic because it brought back everything, and I don't know if it was age or I wasn't medicated at that point because it'd been a couple of weeks since I've had a pill, an antidepressant, but I was able to acknowledge her death, feel it. I mean, and I felt it 100% that night. And then there's scientific data on this as well, and how that affects your brain and how it retrain and how to think about it. So I was forced, may not be the right word, but I was faced with her death again, and I could handle it a different way this time. And that night, you know, it was massive sobbing and things like that, but I had a friend with me who would, you know, check on me and make sure I was okay. They had people that worked for them, the shaman and the people that were there with him, helping him, that made sure you were safe and you were okay while you were still going through all these emotions that you really needed to get through. And I think I had had so many years at that point of pushing everything down that wasn't happy and a smile, that I needed something to help me get out of that. And I think getting the right therapist can do this for you. I don't recommend this for everybody. This mm-hmm. Seemed like the first step because I knew I had to grieve the loss of my daughter. And this just happened to come up because I was seeing a therapist that was wonderful, but it was just, I kept getting that diagnosis of, well, you're depressed. Well, I think I was depressed because I was medicated at that point. And so I didn't have ups and downs and things like that. So they had this baseline for me that was just not real happy. And once I was able to wean off of the antidepressants, I'm happy.
Yeah, it's like you were numb, it sounds like.
I was completely. I had gained weight. I had so much weight. I just didn't want to get up and do anything, you know. And it affected every aspect of my life.
Did this therapist talk to you about your daughter's death?
That one, I switched after that.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the one that I started going to diagnosed me with ADHD. Mm-hmm. And depression could be an aspect of that, too. And so when I was diagnosed with ADHD, I wasn't happy about the medications that were available. And so I started looking at mindfulness, things that I could work on my own that I think at that point I was starting to see that I had it within me to work through my emotions and I would be okay and actually sit in your emotion and feel it. And I had never done that before. I was like 37 or something like that. And that sitting there with that pain, and I came out the next day and I felt so good. Well, I could do this every time. You know, you don't go through that kind of trauma very often. So if it's just a matter of, you know, you don't get that job or you're late because there's traffic, it used to really frustrate me. And the little things would really upset me. And so now it's like, it is what it is. And I talk myself through it. And I cry if I need to cry, or I get mad if I need to get mad. And then, you know, a couple hours later or the next day, I've moved on to the next thing in my life without that dragging behind me. Like, I used to carry things because I didn't deal with them. And so I just have this lightness about me that I don't dwell on things like I did. And I'm able to address them. It's not ignoring them, because that obviously hurt. It didn't help me. But I could address them, give myself the space to address them. You know, I don't do it at work, you know, in the middle of a work day. But give yourself permission to be sad or to get angry. And that was life-changing for me right there, because I just didn't know that was possible.
You gave yourself permission to be a human being?
Yeah.
OMG.
I know.
Awesome.
I mean, and it sounds so simple in retrospect, but if you don't work with somebody who teaches you that, it's really hard. Or even if somebody tells you that, that doesn't change 30 years of programming. And so it really took me a while to get to the point now. And I have the most wonderful, loving boyfriend ever. He's amazing. And I'm at the point now where I said, I'm really sad. I just need to go in the bedroom for a while, and I don't need you to do anything for me. I just need to be sad for a little bit. And he's okay. And he'll, stay out there and give me my space until I work through it. I'll come out, he'll give me a Kleenex, and if I want to talk about it, I can. Otherwise, we move on.
Well, that's lovely. He doesn't run in and try to rescue or fix you, huh?
Well, I think that in the beginning there was that, because he wanted me to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, again, with that philosophy that if you're crying, you're not okay. And I disagree with that now. I think you're healthier when you're crying through something than when you're holding it in. And I think he had somewhat of the same upbringing as I did, but he's very open-minded to different things. And so he would listen when I would tell him about myself and things that I had to work through, and he's very respectful of that.
Well, and you might not even realize what kind of permission that you're giving to him to be more of a fully living human being too. Again, the point of this whole podcast is to try to help people understand that they can be fully human, and they don't have to live in all of this garbage that tells you that you can't, that you have to hold in your emotions and all these false things that we're taught, especially all this exterior stuff. So you're really talking about becoming an internal being, talking to yourself, supporting yourself, allowing yourself just to feel. And this is really wonderful, powerful things. And so I think you shared with me, you're a much happier person now.
Content is a word that I like to use, because I just feel healthy for the first time in my life. And I mean emotionally healthy, because I don't worry about what's going to happen next, because, there's a catastrophe. What am I going to do when that happens? Because now I don't expect anything bad, because I don't worry about anything bad happening, because I know how to handle it. And that's priceless. I mean, that is magic for me, because I was kind of raised with the voice of doom and gloom. I hope nothing else bad happens to you, because, worst case scenario would always be what we'd worry about, and we'd worry. And I wasted so many years worrying about things that never happened. And I don't worry anymore, because something's going to happen, and I'll deal with it as best I can. And it will be hard, and then I'll move on.
So I'm talking to people about finding a lasting, stable happiness. Do you think you have that?
I do, absolutely. And I think with my boyfriend, he and I had dated before, a couple of years ago, and we didn't work out. And I think I was still in that look what I have and look what I can do phase of my life. And so he put up a wall a little bit, because he didn't feel like he could show me his faults either, because I was trying to give the impression that I'm perfect and I don't have flaws. And so now we talk about this sometimes now, where it's been a year now since we've lived together. It'll be a year next month. And we're just both so relaxed and content. And he's kind of been on this journey with me. And it's, like you said, it's allowed him to be himself. So he's more content, because he doesn't have to put up shows.
Pretenses. I call it wearing a mask.
wearing his mask. Exactly. That's exactly what it is, because he's not having to live up to something that I'm, some false, you know, ideal that I'm putting out there. And so this is the healthiest relationship I've ever been in my life. And it's not the easiest, you know, and we both still have our problems and issues, but we can sit down and just to be able to talk about a problem is huge. And it goes so far to help you. Then once it's out there, you can deal with it and resolve it how you need to. And he's able to do that now too. And I think he really has kind of had a lifetime of putting on the happy face as well. So, and he's a generally happy person anyway, but for him to be able to be honest about what he's feeling and not worry about what I'm going to say or that I'm judging him, he's so content as well.
So in a few episodes from now on another podcast show, I'm going to be talking to people about this whole idea of secrets. I call them secrets because we all have these things that we share as human beings, but we don't share with others that we have them. So we think that we're alone in them, and we wear a mask. And there are different levels of masks. There are masks that you wear to others, often that you're aware. You know, here you are acting all smiling and happy, and inside you're thinking, I don't feel so good. But a lot of times you're aware of that. And then you have the deeper mask, the mask that you wear to yourself, which are some of what you've gotten into and moved past. And that, again, opens up. It's like, I tell people, it's like a tea kettle. You stuff and you stuff and you stuff and stuff until it's ready to blow. And people go, well, I feel like I'm going to lose control. And it's like, well, you're not going to lose control. You just don't have any more room to stuff. So there's no place to put it. So when you slowly start letting that out, then you say you're more relaxed, you have more space, you feel lighter. You know, there's actually a physical lightness, a physical opening that happens. And this is why I'm so dedicated to telling people, please understand that this is the human condition and we're all in it together, every single one of us. And you and I have been lucky enough to be on a certain path where we understand that, you know, you can have this lasting, stable happiness. And yeah, that doesn't mean that things don't happen in life that suck. But again, you know how to deal with it. Instead of thinking that the world's going to end or getting all anxious or upset about it, it's like, okay, well, this is just a bump in the road versus the really high or the really lows that you get in life, because it's just part of being alive. There'll be a bump, I can deal with it, and there'll be deader times. And so it doesn't really squash your happiness like it can when you do the highs and the lows and are unrealistic about some things. This podcast is called What the Hell is Going On? And one thing we will talk about is how you can change that confusion and anxiety that goes with the question, what the hell is going on, and transform it into something called WIGO. And we'll talk about the use of WIGO, the acronym for the question, what the hell is going on? WIGO is a word, when you say it out loud, it's kind of like hard to be angry and anxious and upset when you use it. So that's a whole thing that we'll address as we go along, how to transform your thinking and your living from what the hell is going on to WIGO. So, Carrie, do you have any advice or stories or something that you think might be helpful with others who are kind of where you were, who feel like they're struggling and they don't know what direction to go? They're kind of numb to life or they're unhappy. Again, one of the reasons why I'm not really into the drugs is that I'm not really into the labels. And one of the reasons I don't work within these systems is that you are required to put labels on people in order for the insurance to pay. And for somebody to say you're ADHD, well, I mean, you could simply just be part of the anxiety that goes with the depression that you're having, or it could simply just be anxiety that goes with stuffing everything inside. So what's attention deficit disorder? I mean, come on, if you're anxious or you're worried or you've got all this stuff going on, of course you're going to have a deficit disorder. And part of being a human being is sometimes you have deficits in our thinking, you know? Yeah, it's just part of natural things. So I don't really like these labels. So I encourage people not to label themselves and just kind of deal with what it is that's going on, allowing themselves to be a human being. So I'm back to asking you the question when I just went off on my thing. Do you have any advice or stories that you think might be helpful with people who are wanting to know, is there a better way to be?
My first suggestion would always be mindfulness. And I think I grew up thinking, you know, meditation was kind of woo and out there, and it's absolutely changed my life. I mean, and that's something anybody can do. It takes a while, and you may only do it for a minute or two the first time. You can do it a little longer the next time. But to be able to sit and be comfortable with yourself for this length of time, I would never have been able to do that before. The constant thoughts and the things like that, because I was afraid to sit still too long and feel anything. So to be able to sit now, and I do it every day, I mean, and I need it every day, just to be able to sit and quiet my mind, because I do have that monkey brain where I'm always thinking of this and what's going to happen here, and I've always got to be four steps ahead of what's going to happen. And I still have moments like that now, but now I talk to myself. And I have to stop what I'm doing and stop what I'm thinking. And a lot of times I'll just write down little notes on, I'm okay, I'm safe, we'll work this out. And then I have to talk to myself and reassure myself that whatever is happening is okay. And we just have to work on our reaction to it. So I have no control over this. And you really don't have control over much in your life. I mean, a lot of it. And so you need to be able to let that go. And meditation did that for me, and mindfulness has done that for me. And that's something anybody can do. I mean, you can even look up on the internet and how to start it. But it's something anybody can do, and as a first step towards being comfortable with yourself, because I wasn't. I think that was kind of one of the basic problems that I had. I wasn't comfortable with myself because it felt phony to be living this life, but that's all I knew. And so I had to learn. I didn't want to. I always had to be doing something. Even if I'm sitting there, you know, I have to play a Sudoku or something on my phone, or I couldn't have any moments of quiet because then the dark thoughts creep in. And so once I've been able to work through those, once I've been able to look at those, they don't scare me anymore. I mean, I don't...
What kind of dark thoughts?
Just, well, what if I lose my job tomorrow? Or, you know, just random things that I've always... done well with my employment. It's not that, you know, I shouldn't have to, I wouldn't be someone that would have to worry about getting fired tomorrow for anything or, you know, all these things, but I kind of grew up with that doom and gloom, and so even when everything was fine, it was like, well, we got to screw this up because it's, you know, that wasn't a comfort level for me. Being okay wasn't a comfort level, so you go back to what you're comfortable with, and that was stress and chaos. And so I still find myself kind of going back to that sometimes. But if I can sit, if I can slow my mind down enough to think rationally and realistically, that's not going to happen. And why would I waste this time that I have right now? Because our time is precious. Life is finite. And so our time is so valuable. Why would I want to spend it? To just waste it worrying about something that may or may not happen tomorrow. Getting sick, I mean, you know, the coronavirus is here with us now, and a lot of people are worried about that, and you can be precautious, you know, take those precautions that you need to not get sick, but why on earth would I sit and spend my evening worrying about, well, what happens if I get it? And that happens, I could say that about anything, getting in a car accident or, you know, something that might affect your life tomorrow to your detriment, but if I'm going to sit and worry about it today, it's already taken over, and it may not even happen. If I can spend these 4 hours enjoying myself and, you know, finding joy and walking, I like to walk to the library and just walk around, and my boyfriend and I will do that. You know, we'll walk down there and go into the library, and we just enjoy looking at books and getting stuff and walking home. And it's those simple things. I never would have made time for that before. I never would have walked anywhere before. You get in the car and you go. But now I've slowed things down. And to me, that's progress. To some people, it looks like I'm going backwards, but to me, I'm moving forward.
And why would some people think you're going backwards?
I don't know. I don't know. To me, I'm going to a simpler time. To me, it was so much simpler just to be able to walk and do this. And it seems like progress is, well, no, you have to have a nice car so you don't have to walk, you know. And so progress to some people is not having to walk anywhere. And, you know, we both have cars. I mean, I can get there. I can drive there if I need to. But just to be able to go back to that simple, get outside, you know, walk by the park.
And I think that's another fallacy that we have. Somehow we have all this progress. And so, like, I have friends that make fun of me because I don't have a smartphone and I don't text and I'm not on Facebook. And they go, oh, well, how can that be? And it's like, I already have enough stimulus the way it is. I don't want any more. And I don't want to be around any negativity. And, well, I mean, other than what you have to experience in life. And so I'm not interested. It absolutely does not interest me. And that's so foreign to them. But this is kind of what you're talking about. All the things that we do to distract from being with ourselves.
Absolutely.
Because we're afraid. And, you know, my generation, it was, you know, the good old drug, sex, and rock and roll. And then it became the computer was the new drug. Now the smartphone is the new drug, along with Facebook and Twitter and all these things. All the things that we do to distract ourselves from being with ourselves. And what I hear you saying is that being with yourself was the best thing that you ever did.
Oh, it was the greatest experience of my life. And I used to be, my mind would go in loops, you know, when I was young and even getting older, and I could do 10 things at once and I could organize that. And so I was a great employee, you know, because I could get all these things done, but I was just so emotionally unhealthy. I'd go home and be exhausted. It was being that, you know, learning how to be a people pleaser from early on. What was your question?
No, I was just saying that you say the best thing that you ever happened was actually sitting with yourself, which is the one thing that everybody tries to avoid.
And I did.
Yeah. And so how did you get to the point where it was okay to sit with yourself, be with yourself?
Actually, I think it was after the ADHD diagnosis, and because I took that label, I guess, and I started reading about it. And my brain does work differently, I think, than some people, that it races and I have trouble getting caught up with my thoughts. And so I wanted to learn how to slow it down. And so I learned mindfulness and how to watch your thought rather than be your thoughts. And I was able to look at them practically and say, well, that's not okay, or that's not real. It's not real. Some of our thoughts are just the programming coming out, you know, automatically, and that's not a real thing.
It's only real if you make it real.
Well, right, or if you don't stop it. I mean, if it would come to fruition because I thought it was real, you know, I'm going to be unhappy because I thought I was going to be unhappy, and it really taught me how to slow down and watch what I was thinking. And that was huge for me. If you can look at it, you know, like if the thoughts are coming out of your head and see what those thoughts are. And for me, I didn't realize how to do that. And so sometimes, like in the beginning, I would say, well, if my friend said this, what would I think about that? Or, you know, would I be okay with them feeling this way? And because I didn't feel like my feelings were as valid as other people's. And so I had to use that third person or that second person to say, is that normal? Because normal was the word I was using for a long time. And what's normal? And that was my gauge, I guess. I had to gauge it off of somebody else because I had never been taught. And I didn't know how to do it myself, so I would work it as another person, like, well, if this happened to her, would that be okay? You know, to gauge if it was okay for me. Does that make sense?
Yeah. What I'm hearing you talk about, again, is the secrets that people have going on, again, that they think that they're alone. Everybody has a monkey mind, okay? And they will teach you, these great meditators, it's not that they stop their mind. It's not possible to stop their mind. They have trained to the degree where they can focus their mind for lengthy periods of time. They do not stop the mind. And so we all have this mind that goes. And so the trick is to learn to slow it down and to learn not to let these, what do we call it, in rational emotive therapy and these cognitive behavioral therapies and stuff like that, to learn what is thoughts that you have that have no validity. And we all have them. And like you say, it's very important. You are so smart. And I'm so glad that you're here, because your ability to realize that these things are faulty, that they're not based in reality, and that you don't have to go with them, and that they're what can be called catastrophizing. You blow things out of proportion, which just illuminates everything going on and on. This is what you do with cognitive therapy, and you learn that your feelings are produced by your thoughts. And so if you want to feel different, you got to change what you think. And so I'm going to change a word, because you're talking about awareness. You have become aware of yourself. Is that different than mindfulness?
I don't know. I think the awareness is my goal. I want to understand, and I think that's why I read books and I read articles all the time, because it was so hard for me to find, you know, I've stopped going to therapists, basically, because that was coming more from a medical standpoint, and I didn't feel like that was what I needed to get me to the place I am today. And it's really hard to find that person that can lead you through this kind of a journey. And so I just started reading and trying different things. And awareness is an excellent word. I never really thought of it like that, because I'm aware of my thoughts, and I'm also able to divert them or redirect them. And that took a lot of work. It's, you know, it's definitely not, wasn't easy, but it's possible, and it's so worth it. And now it's automatic to me. If I have a negative thought, because I always, you know, we all do, and mm-hmm. that's part of life, and no matter where you are in the journey, but now I can say, you know, if something pops into my head, well, what if it doesn't work out? Well, then I counteract it with, well, what if it does? And which would you rather, which makes you feel better to talk about, you know? And so it's not making me ignorant of what could go wrong. I mean, there's, of course, you know, you know the pros and cons of decisions that you make, but I dwell on the pros now, and this could happen, and this wonderful thing could happen, and this, you know, could be an opportunity to do this. And where before I would say, well, you know, it's going to be a lot of work, and I don't want to do it, and so I would talk myself out of taking risks and doing things that I enjoyed, because I was that negative Nelly that would focus on the bad things that would happen. That will kill you.
It certainly makes you unhappy.
It does.
And there's nobody teaching us not to do it. So I feel like I'm very happy for you that you discovered this on your own. And this is such a great gift for you to come in here and share this so people can hear that there is a better way, that there can be a better way. And I asked you about the mindfulness, because this is this big term that people use. You know, it kind of started with Buddhism, because it was translating Buddhist texts as mindfulness. And then it just became, it's everywhere. Take this mindfulness training. Simply, as an old Buddhist, I've been a Buddhist for a long time. I mean, like 30 plus years. Mindfulness is simply awareness, paying attention, being aware. I tell people, instead of just getting up and rebooting your computer every morning and running on all this faulty software programs, pay attention. And this is exactly what you're saying. Something comes up and you go, oh, well, this is nonsense. I'm not going with that. Let that go. I want people to realize it doesn't have to be this horrible, awesome task. And it doesn't have to be frightening, and it doesn't have to be horrible. It just simply is just, if they don't do anything else, just pay attention. And when something comes up, it's like, oh, where did the hell did that come from? What the hell is going on here? And is there any validity to it? It's like prejudice. Where did you learn prejudice? Did you come up with that on your own? Or did you learn that somewhere? And is there any validity to it? And I can tell you, having been around all kinds of different cultures, there are all kinds of lovely people in every single culture, and there are horrible people in every culture. And unless you're a sociopath, that horrible person is an extremely suffering person who don't know any other way to be than they're put their stuff out on other people. Somebody taught them that. But they can be different. And we can all be different. And so it's a real blessing and a real gift for you to come in and talk to me. And I'm very grateful for this. Is there anything else that you want to share?
The thing that I wish that had happened to me sooner, and it's so simple, it's just such a simple concept, is you have to know that something else is possible. And I just never knew. And I'm a pretty intelligent person, and I just didn't know. This has taken place over a few years. And so I would learn something, and I'd get so fascinated by it. And then once you start on that path, it's just you start feeling better, and every step you take makes you feel a little better. And so it didn't feel like work at the time, really, because it was exciting, and it still is, because I have so much more that I want to learn and feel. But I had to know it was possible.
And that's what I'm trying to tell people. Hey, it's possible. There is another way to be, and guess what? A stable, lasting happiness is possible. But part of what you got to do is become aware of all the crap that you have been taught and all the false stuff that you've been taught and how that affects your self-esteem, how that affects every aspect of your entire life. And this is what we're talking about. And this is what I'm going to be talking about, because I think from my path, my mother's death and going in a direction and then going into therapy myself and becoming a therapist and seeing the suffering in others, there's a part of me that every, you know, I think, oh, well, you know, who are you to do this work? You know, who are you? And I let it go. And then every time I let it go, it comes back to me. And I was feeling that one day when I walked in to get my acupuncture appointment and you and I started having this conversation. It's like, okay, thank you very much, Carrie. I needed to hear this. Do the work. Just shut up and do the work, because people need to hear this. People are dying to hear this. They want to know there's a better way that they can be. And it is possible. And, you know, yes, you can do all kinds of different ways. You can go through a religious thing. You can go through, you know, a therapist. If you go through a therapist, shop. Okay? Because everybody doesn't fit everyone. And if you find a therapist who's going to tell you how you feel or how you think or give you a strong label, then run. Because that's not a person you want to work with, because they're just going to not really help you look at the issues. You want to find somebody who's going to help you help yourself, help you look at your stuff, versus sticking a label on you and saying, okay, well, why don't we take the ADHD drug or take an antidepressant? And what do you mean? You had grief? Oh, I didn't know that. How did you have grief? Why didn't you just deal with it? You know, whatever, however it comes back. But there's so many ways out there that you can go and you can get into some kind of path. You do have to be careful about going with certain groups. If you go with a group and they, again, are telling you how to think or how to feel or how you should be, or you go with some kind of group that non-inclusive, like don't believe what these people are saying, or this is kind of what some people say about Scientology, this big thing about Scientology, you know, everybody's the enemy and we're the only one that's know the truth. I don't know if that's true about Scientology, but if you find an organization like that, run. Because any healthy organization, any kind of healthy group is going to be inclusive, they are going to be inviting, and they're going to help you to figure out things for yourself. They're not going to tell you how to be and what to be. They're not going to be controlling. So you have to watch for these things, because you don't want to fall into a cult, and there are plenty of them out there. So there's all kinds of ways to go. So anything else?
I don't think so.
Well, you know, I'd say I like to stop the podcast or in the podcast with stories about the power of kindness. Do you have any stories about the power of kindness in your life? It doesn't have to be a huge one. I say it doesn't have to be giving somebody a kidney. It could just be you were having a bad day and somebody came up and said, you need a hug, Carrie, and gave you a hug, or anything like that. Any stories?
I don't think I've ever realized the power that one person can have to help somebody else. And I have volunteered off and on all my life at shelters and things like that. And one shelter, they had like a clothes closet, and there was a disabled veteran that came through, and he had ended up homeless, and there were, you know, substance abuse issues and things like that that led him down that path. And so one day I was helping him, you know, people could come through, pick an outfit or two and whatever. He had an interview, and so we picked out an outfit for him to wear to his interview. And also being in human resources, I was very motivational, I think, in that area and what to do with things. And then the next time I saw him, he had gotten a job. And he was in tears. I mean, and to see that, it's like he was so thankful. And a lot of it was just that somebody took the time to talk to him. And everyone at that shelter was so kind, you know, so it wasn't just me. But he took the time to thank me personally, and just being able to talk to someone and ask questions that, you know, as an adult, he probably thought he should know the answer to, and we're all in different categories. I mean, there's, you know, so maybe he didn't know how to, you know, if he could ask this or what should I wear, and he didn't even know what to wear, but having someone help him gave him a little more confidence, and that's huge. And it was nothing that I did monetarily or anything like that. It was talking to him and giving him the comfort level that he could ask me things that he needed to know that a lot of people were afraid to ask because we don't want to look stupid or ignorant or things like that. And I think that was that. I think about that to this day quite a bit.
Yeah. So it sounds like you acknowledged him as a human being and validated him in some way. And so it doesn't seem like it was a big thing, but to him it was.
That's what made me realize the power that words have and just being nice to people.
And how was that for you?
Oh, I just was in tears to know that, because I had kind of shattered self-esteem for many years for various reasons, and I never feel like I had that kind of, I don't know if power is the right word, or I had that much power over somebody else's feelings. And you do, and you can do it negatively or you can do it positively, still have a powerful effect. But to spread that to him, it was amazing. I mean, it was just one of the best moments of my life. So he gave back to me something that I can't replace. It was just wonderful, the feeling that I got from it.
I tell people there's a wonderful song by Tori Kelly and the Muppets called Kindness. And you listen to it, it's so uplifting because it talks about this very idea that helping others helps you. And you did this kindness to him. And really, you have no power over how he feels. He has no power. I can be hateful to you and you have the power whether or not to let that bother you or not. But a kindness, there's something about kindness and the power of it. And I don't mean power like people talk, oh, I want power. I just mean that just an act of kindness is so rewarding for both people. And it creates a kind of happiness and it touches your heart. It's a wonderful thing.
It is.
So I want to thank you again, Carrie, for coming in and talking to me and sharing with people. And hopefully someone will hear this, listen to the podcast and think, wow, maybe there's a better way. We'll see where it goes from there. I've asked that people please email me at mllaurie@kboo.org and share your comments or your questions, and I will include that in the podcast. Since my last podcast, I got an email from Zaki who said, very powerful, kindness, calm, patience, all very difficult but rewarding. Thank you, Zaki, for your comments. I hope that you're being kind to yourself and that you'll tune into my next episode. So please stop for a minute and think about all we've been talking about today. I'm ML Laurie.